This is Forward, Reel 2. You said you had to supply your own uniform. What were you told to buy?
I don't know. We were sent somewhere, I presume, where you could get it. We were measured for it. But where, I can't remember.
Were you given any allowance for it?
I think we were, yes. I've got an idea we were. We were then later issued with these fur-lined flying boots and fur-lined jackets and these, for the open plains, these fur-lined boiler suits, well, flying suits, you know, old ones. And then when we... not immediately, but later on we were issued with these fur-lined leather flying jackets.
How adequate was this uniform issue?
Oh, it was very warm. Oh, I don't think it was. I know we bought our own shirts and things like that, you know. Shoes and stockings and things.
But the fur-lined clothes...
Those were all the same as the Air Force wore. They were all Air Force issue. They're exactly the same boots and coats that the Air Force wore.
For your uniform as such, was it skirts or trousers?
It was skirts. We were allowed trousers, obviously, because you couldn't get into a boiler suit without. We always had to carry our skirt with us and change into it the moment we landed.
Why was that?
Because in those days you didn't walk around in trousers. It was not done. It was a different generation.
When you'd flown before the war, had you worn trousers or skirts?
Oh, always, yes. I always wore trousers. And I wore trousers at Croydon.
So this was an ATA regulation that women should not wear trousers?
Yes, but I didn't wear trousers in public. I mean, on the aerodrome, yes, obviously, and flying. But I changed into a dress or a skirt when I left the... I mean, I didn't walk around London in trousers, let's put it that way. And I didn't go to a pub in trousers or anything like that.
So this ATA regulation was a continuation of normal practice?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, women didn't wear trousers in those days, except when you were on a job and you had to, you know, obviously.
Can you tell me what happened when you first reported for work?
The photographers arrived, as you probably saw from the cuttings, and took endless photos. And I think we did get around to flying the first day, but only just. I think we did a very short journey and were collected in a fox moth with a pilot sat on top, and there was a little cabin down below for four people.
I know that the press were very interested in the original eight women flyers.
Yeah.
How did you feel about this press coverage?
We just laughed, you know. I mean, I'd been battered by the press to such an extent when I took my second-class navigator's license that it didn't really bother me very much, because also the fact that I played ice hockey. And things that, you know, I was rather used to it. And the fact that they never put down what, rather like they do nowadays, they never put down what you told them, but always something from their imagination. I mean, they insisted my father was a millionaire, which was far from the truth.
Why had they been interested in your second-class navigator's course?
Because I was the first woman to actually get the license. I think there were three or four who'd taken the exam before me, but they hadn't got the flying hours, because you had to have a minimum of 250 flying hours and I don't know how many hours, and a certain number of night flying hours as well, before they handed you the license.
When you started with ATA, did you feel on the whole the press was sympathetic to women flying?
Yes, very much so. And, of course, the test pilots at Hatfield were marvellous. They were very, very friendly. There was the Tudor Havilands, John and Jeffrey de Havilland and a man called Gibson, a man called Fillingham. That's their wedding present to me, that ashtray, that cigarette box with all their names on it. And they were charming to us, absolutely charming. All three of them are dead now. John de Havilland was a great friend of ours.
Did any of the eight women pilots find it a strain being photographed and interviewed by the press?
No, I don't think so. I think they all rather enjoyed it. No. I mean, I don't think they didn't pester us to the extent that they pester people nowadays, you know. Besides, it was wartime and they could only take a certain amount of photos. Anyway, poor Pauline Gars and Chuck them out. They became a nuisance, you know. Any case, was 7 day wonder. You know, once after the first few weeks, we settled down and then nothing, and got on with our job, and that was it.
Could you tell me now what your duties were when just the eight of you were the only ones flying?
Well, to start with, we were ferrying these Tigers chiefly to up to Scotland, and then catching the train back and getting another plane the next day and flying back again. It was just a matter of up and down the whole time, generally stopping off for a night on the way, especially in the winter, you know, because days weren't long enough, the weather was bad. And then we went for a conversion course onto Oxfords. And then we flew endless Oxfords, which were twin-engine, also training aircraft, and we flew those for quite a long time, and then started on fighters, and that was the beginning, and after that we flew anything that came along. I mean, we never knew when we arrived in the morning what plane we'd be given. Just given one or two planes. Sometimes we delivered somewhere and picked another plane up the same place and flew it on somewhere else. Other occasions you'd deliver a plane and a taxi would collect you, drop you somewhere else where you picked up another plane which brought you back nearer home, and then you'd be picked up by another taxi and brought home. You know. Sometimes you spent the night away.
When you first started flying to Scotland, did you fly together?
I don't know how long, but certainly for the first week or two we used to fly in gaggles of about four of us.
How did you find that? Had you done formation flying before?
Well, yes, we had at Brooklands for fun. You know, we'd done a bit of formation flying. But, I mean, it wasn't tight formation. We just followed one another and hoped for the best.
Did you have to put down at airfields on the way?
Yes, I think we did. We hadn't got enough petrol to go all the way to Scotland. We had to, generally Shrewsbury, but Shrewsbury was a halfway mark. And then we used to fly on from there. And once, I force landed with three others behind me in a field at Shrewsbury because the weather had clamped down. That didn't go down too well because we'd been told not to. But the first week, you know, that happened, which was however nothing. We all got off safely the next day. The police came and put a guard on the planes, and we spent the night in the village and took off the next day. It was a huge field, so there was no harm done.
Why were you told not to do that?
I don't know. Probably because it didn't. You know, the first few weeks they wanted everything to be perfect. They didn't want to have to report any forced landings or anything.
How frequently would you have to make overnight stops?
Oh, it varied a lot. I really couldn't tell you. I suppose at least once a week, sometimes twice. One was in the latter days of the war. well, not latter days, mid-war, I suppose, my husband was stationed up at Doncaster. And we used to fly a lot of Hurricanes and Spitfires up, I don't know where, but north of there. And I used to try and get one when I got back in the evening from day's work. I used to try and pick one up if they had one to spare, fly up to Doncaster and go along to the pub where Alan used to meet me, and we used to spend the night together. And the next morning I'd take off, and wherever he was having his exercises I used to dive bomb him, you know, as practice, and then fly on to where we were going. That I managed to do that several times, because you know, one had to grab every minute in those days. One could be together, one was always separated. It was great fun.
What was official reaction to you doing this?
Oh, I mean, they knew. I'd asked permission to, I said my husband's stationed up there, can I land there for the night and then go on, and they never minded.
How long was your day?
That varied. I'm in the winter, very short, obviously, but in the summer, sometimes very long indeed, because we might have kept waiting for a couple of hours, and we might go and find the plane wasn't ready, or something was wrong with the plane, you had to wait for a couple of hours for it to be repaired. And then you'd wait because the taxi was late. You know, you might not get back till 6, 7 at night. So sometimes 8. It varied awfully. But they were quite long days. I mean, we had a long weekend once a fortnight. And I know we were always very worn out. You know, all I wanted to do was to sleep.
Whereabouts were you living?
Originally, I stayed in London. And then I moved out to Hatfield for a time. And then moved back to London. But it was a bit dicey because London was being bombed, and you know, you never quite knew whether you were going to get through or whether the streets would have been barricaded off or something. And then, of course, we were shifted to Luton, and that was too far in any case. So I moved out to lovely house in Luton, and Mrs. Pilkington, who took three of us in, paying guests. And that was lovely. And that was only about a quarter of an hour, 10 minutes drive from the airport.
When and why were you moved to Luton?
I don't know why. Because we had the whole aerodrome to ourselves. Hatfield, of course, was mosquitoes. Well, when we started, tigers, and then mosquitoes. And whether Hatfield wanted to get rid of us because we were getting too big, I think they wanted to enlarge the pool, and Luton was the ideal place because it was empty. So they could, you know, enlarge it and have the whole place for themselves.
So was it just an all-woman pool at Luton?
Well, I think so, but I'm almost sure it was, yes, it was an all-woman's pool.
Did you have any choice as to where you could go to, which ferry pool?
You could ask for transfer if you particularly wanted it for some reason or other, because there was a pool at Eastleigh, another woman's pool, and there was another woman's pool somewhere else. There were three or four in all. But on the whole, I liked to be near London, so, you know.
Could you tell me what the chief hazards were that a ferry pilot had to endure?
No wireless. And you couldn't... you had to fly below cloud, because that's how Amy got killed, by flying above cloud and not being able to come down. And we lost several that way.
This is Amy Johnson.
Yes. And because without a wireless, it's fatal to go above cloud, because you just don't know where you are. And So really bad weather was the worst hazard. Kind of try and fly along below cloud and still get there. And of course you had all the balloons. You had to know where all the balloons were, because there were these huge balloons all over the Midlands and protecting any vital places, you know, harbours and old towns and places, you know, so you had to know your way around.
Did you have a map to show you where the balloons were?
Well, they were, yes, vaguely, but you knew most of them by heart. And if any new ones were put up, they always put up on a map in the office, you know, that you always checked it before you left. And we knew our routes that were free, the balloons, and had to stick to them, because if you got tangled up in them, it was hopeless. And of course, we never really took it seriously, but on several occasions, rumours went around, oh, the Germans have landed on the East Coast, or you can't fly to, up here somewhere, Cologne. The Germans have parachuted in there, you know. And we went up there and landed and said, where are the Germans, you know? They said, haven't arrived yet. But you know, always rumours flying around.
Did you ever encounter any German planes when you were in the air?
I saw German planes bombing airfields, yes. But always kept my distance, obviously.
Was it a worry that you might encounter them?
In those days, you know, one didn't worry about things much. You know, I mean, one wouldn't have done the job if one'd been a worrying kind, if you know what I mean. You just took it in the day's work, and that was it. Flew off and hoped that when you turned round they'd have gone away, you know. You couldn't, you wouldn't have been flying aeroplanes in wartime if you worried about little things like that, you know.
What about the cloud levels? Did you ever fly above cloud, even though you weren't meant to?
No, I didn't. No. I mean, yes, if it was just a little cloud, you know, nothing. But I wouldn't go above the cloud, no. No, I've seen too many people killed doing that. No, I always kept below, even if I had to go down to 100 feet, 200 feet. I mean, I'd hop across telephone lines, to telegraph lines, rather than go above cloud. At least you knew where you were.
How did you cope with not having a wireless when you were used to flying with one?
Well, I wasn't. I was only used to flying with a wireless at night. I'd done all my other cross-country flying without a wireless. It was only at night that we had, from flying from Croydon, that we had to have wireless operators. But otherwise, I'd never had wireless. I mean, I'd flown all over Europe without a wireless.
Did this mean you had no contact with the aerodrome when you were landing?
None at all. What happened at Croydon was, and as far as I remember, at most aerodromes, you circled the control tower and they flashed you a red light if they didn't want you to land, and they flashed you a green light if you were allowed. Certainly Croydon flashed you a green light, which meant you were allowed to land. And as far as I remember, all these French and Austrian and Hungarian aerodromes had the same thing. You circled the control tower and they flashed a green light at you.
What did you do if you had any problems?
What kind of problems?
Problems with the aircraft, for instance.
You force landed.
Did you have to do that?
No. Only time when I killed a cow. There was an 88 plane and the engine cut and I had to force land. Yes, I've had the odd forced landings, but nothing serious, you know.
You had to land in a field when this engine cut?
I landed in a field and wretched Jersey cow ran in front of me and I hit it and went up on my nose. And the cow was killed, of course. Cost the ATA £150, which in those days was a lot of money. It was pedigree Jersey, in calf, of course. Unless the farmer was having us on. And it was a ropey old heart, which was being flown for scrap, literally. I was flying it somewhere for it to be scrapped, just to get rid of it, you know. And then it didn't come. And that was all right. No harm done. And
what degree of responsibility did the ATA have then over your actions? You say they had to pay for this cow.
Well, I mean, presumably they had insurance. I've no idea. But, I mean, the farmer claimed on them. And that was it. I mean, if you destroy somebody's property, you wouldn't pay for it.
Did you have to explain your actions to the ATA?
I just told Pauline what had happened. She took it for granted, you know. I mean,
were there ever any official investigations into accidents or forced landings?
Oh, yes, they were officially. Very much so. Yes, but I don't think there were any cases where it was blatant that something, you know, was done that shouldn't have been done. I mean, I think they were all genuine, the forced landings that there were. And
you said that weather was the other main hazard. What was the policy as regards weather?
Well, we could shoot ourselves. There were certain weather conditions when they literally said no flying, obviously. But when it was like that, touch and go, they'd say, well, if you like to fly, you can try it. If you find you can't get through, come back. And on numerous occasions, we landed at Air Force aerodromes where they'd shut down. They weren't flying at all because of the weather, and we landed, took off again. And they had no jurisdiction to stop us. We had a special pass which gave us, which meant was our responsibility whether we flew or not, and not the control tower. I couldn't stop us.
Did anybody ever question your decisions?
Well, yes, they sometimes told us we were mad. I mean, the various aerodromes where they'd closed down, they said, you can't fly in this weather, we aren't. We said, well, we can. And we did. But, you know, it was all fun.
Did you ever encounter any prejudice from the people in the control tower or at the RAF?
No, never. They were absolutely charming. Always. And always very, very helpful. And the maintenance men and people who handed over the aeroplanes, they were always helpful. They always showed us where things were and gave us odd tips and, you know. Because until we had these notes, they were the only contact we had with the plane. They told us where the throttle was and where petrol was and what to do when you wanted to put your wheels up or down and things like that, you know. Then we did have these notes, which were absolutely marvellous. What lives, and, well, notes about everything, what to do, you know.
How long was it before you had those?
I don't know. It was some time. It was probably the second year we were flying.
And did you have your own personal copy? Did you have your own personal copy?
We had a whole bunch of them like that, with all the planes that we were likely to fly. Oh, yes, we each had our own little bunch of them.
And what was your opinion of them?
They were excellent. They were first class. Because they gave you all the information you needed. You know, and then the man on the ground showed you where those knobs were if you couldn't find them. They were absolutely valuable.
How did you cope with flying all these different aircraft?
Well, you got used to it. It was a challenge, I suppose, and you got used to it. And it was fun, you know. You enjoyed flying a new plane. A bit apprehensive to start with, especially landing, not taking off so much, but one was always a bit apprehensive of landing the first time on a strange plane, because some of them had, like Mosquito, if you were landing in the in a crosswind, which you had to sometimes, the plane would veer across. They were quite tricky to land, Mosquitoes. And other planes, You know, they had their little... quirks. Let's put it that way. You know, you had to know. So the first time you landed a plane was always a bit of a traumatic experience. And after that, you know, you didn't mind.
And were these idiosyncrasies spelled out in the ferry pilot's notes?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And it did warn you about the mosquito. But I think we flew a mosquito before we had notes. I don't know. Most of the planes were all right, you know, there was no trouble with them. But in any case, when you were flying, there was talk with the engines. You know, they pulled you to one side as you landed, so you would have used a little more throttle to keep on the straight line. As I say, you got used to them. It wasn't too difficult.
Were any aeroplanes harder for a woman to fly than a man?
Some were a bit heavier than others, but none that difficult. But some were a bit heavier, yes.
And what about things like the cockpit layout? How well was that adapted to a woman's physique?
All right. Some were awkward. I mean, some were more awkward than others, and others were easy, you know. You got used to them.
What did you do if you had an awkward plane to fly?
You just flew it. I mean, what else could you do, you know? It wasn't that bad. Don't forget, we'd all had a lot of experience in flying. You know, it's rather like, I mean, I don't know how long or how many different cars you've driven. It's like driving different cars, you know, except you're on the ground, so you know, you can just stop if you don't know what to do. But, you know, you get used to it.
If there was a type of aircraft you didn't like to fly, could you avoid flying that one?
No. You moaned when you saw the chits all laid out in the morning. Oh, my God. So you moaned, but otherwise you just did it.
Who told you what you were going to fly?
Whoever was in charge of the... Pauline Gower did most of it, and... She had a secretary, and they planned the day's flights for the various pilots who was available, you know, and when it was all fairly complicated, because everybody had to be collected and dropped and collected again, you know, so it was a fairly complicated business in the end, not to start with, but when fairly large pools of girls, so.
Did you ever fly the taxi?
Once or twice, yes. Oh, to start with,